The next case is 08395, Disciplinary Counsel versus Henry Freeman. Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. The respondent in this matter, Henry Freeman, used his IOLTA account as a personal and operating account since he began practicing law in the 1980s, both commingling funds and causing overdrafts. The respondent also failed to cooperate in two separate investigations over a 14-month period when he failed to respond to 9 separate letters. It's undisputed that the respondent suffers from adjustment disorder with mixed anxiety and depressed mood, and that this condition makes it so that he's unable to handle legal matters beyond those that are routine. It is for that reason Relator has objected to the board's recommendation and is requesting that this court order a 1-year suspension with 6 months stayed to both protect the public and to allow the respondent to complete his recovery. Relator has set out its arguments in its brief, and I won't repeat those today, but I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Is there a course of treatment that he's engaged in at the moment that has an end point?
In the record, Your Honor, it's established that he's been seeking treatment from a Dr. Lowendahl, and that his treatment is somewhere between 70% to 75% completed. Both the doctor and the respondent offered evidence that his treatment was not complete.
And what is the... He does bankruptcy work, is that?
Your Honor, he testified he did bankruptcy, family law, and probate. That was the primary areas of his practice.
So under your view, he ought to be out for 6 months while he completes treatment. But that also involves a pretty substantial disruption to routine for someone who's already having problems coping with anything that's not routine.
Your Honor, the respondent testified at the hearing that he had somewhere between 10 to 20 clients, so it does not appear as if he's practicing full-time at this time, that his practice is something less than full-time.
So you think that shutting down completely should be something that he could handle without damage to those clients that are in midair?
Based upon the fact that there's a variety of attorneys available in the region of the state that he lives who could take over the cases, we wouldn't expect extraordinary hardship for the clients, no, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And the impact, then, of the board's recommendation of a 1-year stayed suspension would permit Mr. Freeman to continue practicing during the year of his suspension.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Correct? And the difference is, if we adopt the position you're advancing, he would just not practice for a period of 6 of those months.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then would he have to reapply, or would he automatically be returned, or what would your recommendation be in that regard?
What we requested for his reinstatement to the practice of law be that he submit some sort of documentation from his treating psychologist that he has completed a sustained period of successful treatment and that he is capable of competently practicing law. Those are the two concerns that we have currently.
Would that also, or could that also be a requirement of the board recommendation on a stayed suspension?
I'm not sure that I understand the question, Your Honor.
The reinstatement would require that Mr. Freeman evidence completion of his treatment.
The concern that we have, the basis for our objection is we have concerns that the public is not adequately protected if he's practicing law during a stayed suspension.
But could there not be a requirement on a stayed suspension that before that suspension is lifted, there also be some medical evidence demonstrating completion of a course of treatment?
Certainly, Your Honor. But
is that part of the board, is that part of the board recommendation at the moment?
No, Your Honor. No, it is not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Freeman, the respondent, has waived oral argument. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The next case is 08-08-396, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Donald M. Powers, Jr. Mr. Klain.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Honors. Frank Klain, and with me is Hammond Bailey, co-counsel of the Bar Association, the relator in this matter. The facts are important to review in this case. In this individual case, the respondent, Mr. Powers, pled guilty in federal district court to filing a false statement on a loan application and also filing false income tax returns. As part of that plea agreement, he entered into a, as part of that arrangement, he entered into a plea agreement where there are certain statement of facts made and affirmed to by Mr. Powers, and we've also entered into a stipulation between relator and respondent as to these facts and some additional facts. I think that those facts are important in reviewing this matter because of the seriousness of this matter. The panel below recommended an indefinite suspension. The relator, Cincinnati Bar Association, feels that a disbarment is appropriate. The key points, I think, in this particular matter, and I think we have to look through them, I'd just like to maybe reiterate them to them. I know they're stated in our brief. Is that the respondent ran a title company that was involved in numerous real estate closings in the Cincinnati area. And these are statements that he acknowledged to in the federal plea agreement. Indicated that he acknowledged that it was involved in a loan flipping scandal. He also closed 310 loans that were involved in flipping matters. And that he was aware that in these particular transactions, that there was fraudulent or fictitious appraisals were submitted in order to obtain these loans. In addition, there were false HUD statements filed in these particular closings which generated the final closing and the lending by the particular mortgage companies. The respondent was also aware that the buyers did not bring down payments to some of the closings, and in fact, the buyers would receive kickbacks outside of the closing. The respondent also acknowledged that in this particular plea agreement that as part of this overall flipping arrangement is that there were false W-2s, false bank verifications, and other fraudulent documents that were created to perpetuate this particular flipping arrangement. I think it's also important to point out that the respondent himself was involved in five transactions which involved flipped properties. We've cited those in our brief, but I'd just like to highlight the two of them that are also highlighted in the statement of facts which was presented in the plea agreement. The one property was a Carl Street property which he purchased on September the 5th of 01 for $37,000 and subsequently in December of that year sold it for $78,000. He acknowledged that there was no down payment. He also acknowledged that he filed a false HUD statement on this, and he also, in his statement of facts, acknowledged the scheme was to defraud First Union, which was the lender in that particular situation. The second transaction involved a piece of property on Law Street, which he purchased in November of 01 for $6,000 and subsequently sold in May of 2002 for $111,000. Again, there was no down payment brought to the closing. The HUD statement was also signed, which was a false HUD statement, which acknowledged that there was a down payment brought to the closing. And he also acknowledged in that particular transaction that it was done to defraud the ABN AMRO. These are statements of facts made in the plea agreement. Now, the overall effect of this in the plea agreement was that the actual or intended loss to the trust companies that were involved, or the lending companies that were involved, was approximately $3,400,000. The defendant also acknowledged that he had failed to file tax returns for 2000, or not, sorry, he filed false income tax returns for 2001 and 2002. In reviewing this, the hearing panel, we believe in making its decision, ignored some of these critical facts in making its decision. We understand that the hearing panel obviously is the trier of the facts. However, we feel that if you go back and review the record in this particular case, that the hearing panel apparently felt that Mr. Powers, the respondent's involvement was limited, and that he relied on others to the detriment of this whole particular type of transaction, and also to himself and to others. However, I think it specifically ignores all of these factual statements that he made in this particular plea agreement, which he made with the federal government in order to receive a reduced sentence or reduced punishment in this particular case.
Mr. Klain, could I ask the impact on the purchasers of this property, when you're the two that you've highlighted? I mean, there's a vast discrepancy between the price that he paid and then the price that it was actually sold for later on. Were any of the individuals involved in these transactions then foreclosed in their homes?
The record that was presented below is not clear as to what happened on those, but I think that it's my recollection reviewing the transcript that, you know, questions were asked on that, and that was the potential that the properties, the people could not support the mortgages on the properties were foreclosed. I think the end effect of it is that the trust companies obviously sustaining these types of losses obviously had to go back to foreclosures or other actions to recoup their dollars. I mean, that's how this was put together by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in their presentation to the Federal District Court.
So the impact was on individuals as well as the institutions that were defrauded.
We would certainly anticipate that individuals were these were in the particular loan flipping scandals that were involved. These were individuals that I don't want to speculate on this, but because of the indication that there were false W-2s, false bank statements, false credit verifications, and we would suspect that the individuals would not have been able to qualify for the particular loans involved. And also with the inflated, the inflated appraisals created also situations where there was a lot larger value there than actually existed. So we would anticipate that, yes, you know, individuals did suffer losses on it. We don't have any ideas to the extent of their losses or number of bankruptcies nor foreclosures. That's not in the record. In reviewing this matter, I think that one of the concerns that we had is that it was the issue of judicial estoppel. You know, it was our position in the hearing was that the respondent could not take a position which we felt was inconsistent with the position that he had taken in his plea agreement, and that we felt that the arguments presented and the hearing panel allowed him to testify onto these issues, which we felt contradicted his position with regards to the plea agreement. And we felt that that was impermissible, and we argued that to the hearing panel. And it basically allowed, we felt, him to minimize his involvement and also to shift the burden to others within the agency, including his ex-wife, his partner, and other employees. As a matter of fact, that his ex-wife and one of the other individuals also had served prison time. I'm not certain as to whether they're still in prison or not. A number of other people have also sustained, subjected to prison sentences. You know, we felt that, you know, the law was very clear, is that you can't take one position in one court and then turn around in another forum and take another position to your benefit after. And we've cited case law in our brief to this effect. There's also a governance bar rule, which indicates that once there is a conviction and it's of record, that that's absolutely conclusive. We felt that that was also very, very strong in providing direction to the hearing panel.
Mr. Klain, let me ask you. The plea agreement, which is attached here, doesn't seem to be quite as specific as the stipulation. The stipulation seemed to be more damning to him, if you will, because he admits in the stipulation that he participated, the institutions have suffered actual or intended loss. He signed HUD forms, falsely certified the buyers had brought down payment. I guess I'm here, unfortunately we don't have respondent to be here, but having not filed a brief, but it does seem to me that the panel, I can't quite understand the panel's observation at the end of its report, that simply note that he found respondent's testimony extremely compelling and credible, and finds the respondent had a limited involvement in the criminal and fraudulent conduct involved in the federal case, notwithstanding the general acknowledgments made in the record in federal court. It seems to me he did, I mean, it seems to me he's admitted that he did more than just, he wasn't a sort of a disinterested or a partially interested party to this. He was active, and he signed documents fraudulently, and I'm making your case, but it seems to me, can you explain to
I can,
why
I
the
think
panel,
I can explain. I think in the testimony,
the panel went awry. I mean, I
don't know how they arrived at that particular decision, but I think the testimony of the respondent was that he had limited involvement, that he would go into the office in the beginning of the day, and he would review some paperwork, but that he was not actively involved in the actual closings, that he would sign documents. The record also indicates this is a title agency that was doing approximately 150 to 200 title closings a month at a net profit to the agency of $500 per closing. So there were a lot of closings going on. However, you know, that weighed against the fact that he personally was involved in at least five transactions, and also the statements that he had made that he was aware of what had happened, that there were false appraisals. There was a disconnect, we felt. And in the hearing panel, I can't speak for the hearing panel, but in reviewing their decision, it appeared that they had really ignored the severity of it and the losses that were sustained by the various lenders and the losses to, and the damage to the general public. We felt that the facts clearly established those and that they should rely more upon the facts and the statement presented both in the stipulation and the statement in the plea agreement. Felt that the hearing panel, you know, believed Mr. Powers in his testimony, found that it was credible and compelling, but also but their initial recommendation appeared to be that this suggested that there should be a disbarment, but they changed it to an indefinite suspension. And they also indicated that he had been subject to serious sanctions for the same misconduct involved in this case through having been sentenced to a federal prison. Well, we recognize that's a situation. Certainly it's a tragedy for Mr. Powers, it's a tragedy for his family. However, you know, that was the consequence of the plea agreement, and that's what he received for breaking the law. Here we're in a different situation. We're talking about his license and his responsibilities to the public and to our profession. And you know, we would certainly anticipate that any attorney, and I'm sure it's not the case of all attorneys that come before this position, that they're contrite and sorrowful and remorseful, and certainly that's what we would anticipate, and I'm certain that that's what Mr. Powers is as a respondent. But I don't know that that necessarily excuses the underlying conduct. In this particular case, we're dealing with three DRs, which involve fraud, illegal conduct, moral turpitude. We're dealing with the ones that we see very frequently. And so we think that it really rises to that level, that this should be a disbarment. Finally, Your Honors, I would also point out that in the hearing before in the decision of the hearing panel, they recommended indefinite suspension, but nothing was meant or said with regards to restitution in this particular case. And I think that in all the cases that I've been able to review, that where there are indefinite suspensions and there are financial obligations, that part and parcel of any indefinite suspension is a monetary, a requirement of monetary restitution. In this case, in the underlying federal case, the federal court assessed a fine of $150,000 that he also repaid to Internal Revenue Service approximately $34,000. There was an initial restitution order of $1.6 million to Trust Corp. Subsequently, it's our understanding that, and I think there's testimony in the record, pages 77 through 82 or somewhere in that thereabouts, that an agreement had been arrived at that Mr. Powers would repay $500,000 by way of restitution. No agreement, as of the time of the hearing in February, had been finalized with regards to any restitution. So it's the position of the Bar Association, Cincinnati Bar Association, this is a case that requires disbarment, but in the event that this court would decide that an indefinite suspension would be more appropriate, that certainly a restitution order has to issue in this particular case to address those issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. The respondent, having not timely filed a brief, waives oral argument. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.